All right, we return to the book of Genesis, and this evening we start the Joseph story. So most of us are pretty familiar with it, but it's good just to go and take a fresh look at it and to be reminded of the great truths in it. And certainly, you know, as we come to the Joseph story, we're coming to the close of the book of Genesis. So it's exciting for me to kind of think back and reflect about all the things that we've learned as we've walked through Genesis and see a lot of the themes and the purposes as we've walked through this book come to culmination as we conclude this book. So a lot here for us to learn, and we'll just dive in. I think most of us have, at least were here last week and have an idea of where we've been. But just briefly, remember that there are 10 sections within the book of Genesis, 2 halves. Really, I don't know if Moses used his 2 hands. I mean, that's kind of the structure. You have one section of 5 in chapters 1 through 11, and another group of 5 in chapters 12 through 50. And so in chapters 12 through 50, you start with the Abraham narrative. Basically, the 3 major sections are the Abraham narrative, the Jacob narrative, and then the Joseph narrative. And then in between those, you have the genealogy of Esau and the genealogy of Ishmael and the genealogy of Esau. And so each one of those genealogies are just kind of, if you will, kind of cement in between the 3 major sections that emphasizes God's election and God's choice of Isaac over Ishmael and of Jacob over Esau. And so it just continually emphasizes God's choice and God's election as he's bringing about his line and his seed and, of course, his purpose that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 and the tracing of the seed of the woman. And so as we come to the end of the book of Genesis, we're going to see how, you know, Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to his 12 sons, and then how those 12 sons go into Egypt and, of course, become a nation as we move into Exodus. And that's where we'll move from Genesis, obviously. And so anyway, hopefully that gives us a little bit of a perspective of where we're going, continuing to trace how God's plan is to work through the nation of Israel. And obviously, it's amazing to just sit back and reflect on how God turns these single individuals into this massive nation. And very unexpected way, I think, if we were to sit down and think about it, bring them to Egypt as under bondage and all that. It's an amazing plan. And that really is the emphasis as we go to the Joseph story. The emphasis is that God is moving nations. God's in control. God is sovereignly working out his plan, even in ways that we can't understand. And certainly we've seen that earlier in the Jacob cycle. We saw how God is working out his plan and purpose even in spite of Jacob's deception. But in this section, similar focus, but even somewhat of a different emphasis, as God seems to be working on even maybe more of a global scale here as he's dealing with Pharaoh and the nations as a whole. And so also you see a lot more of God's providence. In one sense, I shouldn't say more, because we've seen his hidden providence, even in the choosing of Isaac's wife and those kinds of things. But in the Joseph story, you really see God's, I guess if you could put it this way, good timing. You know, how it's amazing how Joseph ends up just here at just this right time, so he could get on this caravan, so he can end up in this Potiphar's house, so he could end up in this prison, so he could be
God's
there.
God's providence.
Exactly. Just over and over again, just the right timing of everything, so that Joseph would end up as the ruler of Egypt, so that when the famine came, he would be there. So then, I mean, you just go on and on. You see how many steps had to take place in sequence for God to work that out. And it's not God's not necessarily in the forefront of everything. Like, God did this, and God did this, and God did this, you know, explicitly stated in the text. But it's kind of the thread that runs throughout the whole Joseph story that ties it all together. And really the lesson for us is God is going to bring about his plan. We've seen that already so much throughout the book of Genesis. But it's a great way to conclude, just with such a great reminder of God's sovereignty, that he's in control. And along with that, we see even how God uses individuals. We see Certainly Joseph as, I would say he's characterized here as a man of wisdom. Some people even say it parallels this section, a lot of the wisdom literature that you find later in the Old Testament, like in Proverbs and some of those different kinds of things. And obviously it was written earlier, so it's not like it was copying that, but there are a lot of those themes that just portray Joseph as a wise man. And so there's a lot of lessons just to learn about that, just for us personally, similarly to how we learned about Abraham, that God's bringing about his purpose, but he uses those who have faith in him. And now we kind of see a similar thing. God's bringing about his purpose, but he uses those who are wise. And so you could kind of see some of those themes as an example. And so those two things kind of run parallel as we walk through this section. And we also see, it's probably good to bring out, you also see the interplay and the interrelation of the 12 different tribes in their 12 founding fathers. And so even as Lewis pointed out last week, we saw how Simeon, the oldest brother, because of the wicked act he did with his father's concubine, gets skipped over. We saw Levi and we saw which ones was it? Levi and it's in chapter 34 here. I should know which brothers it was. Simeon. There you are. In 34:25. Anyway, that they get skipped over because of what they did. And so ultimately the line goes to Judah. And so it's interesting. The reason I bring that out is you walk through the Joseph story. Certainly Joseph is the main character, but you also see Judah being somewhat of a main character, and obviously he's going to be the one through whom the Messiah comes. He's the royal line through whom King David comes. And so we need to watch some of these interplay and relationships among the brothers to see how all that works out as well. And that, once again, just emphasizes how God's working through individuals. He's working through circumstances to bring about his plan. And you see that at the end of Genesis when God's, you know, when Jacob blesses his 12 sons and he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah. And so anyway, we'll see just God's plan and his sovereignty working out even in the formation of the nation at such an early point in time. Okay, any questions there? Just as that kind of gives us a little bit of framework. We'll probably spend 3 weeks working through the Joseph narrative. But just a lot to learn there. And just watch for those themes as we walk through here. Watch how God's working. Watch how he's bringing about such amazing plan and purpose even through this story. Okay, any other comments or questions before we dive in? All right, so chapter 37 of Genesis. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned in the land of Canaan. Now technically, that verse goes with the previous section. Because then you'll notice verse 2 starts, these are the records of the generations of Jacob. And we said that these are the generations of, that's what forms the heading for each of these 10 sections within the book. So verse 2 really starts the last section of the book of Genesis. And it says, Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back an evil report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that his father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him peaceably. So that's the introduction here. It starts off with that heading, these are the generations of, and that's what, you know, certainly, you know, sets this section apart. But even as you read it kind of from a literary standpoint, the Joseph narrative is different than anything we've encountered thus far in the book of Genesis. It really is one long story from beginning to end. It starts with him as a young man, and it ends with his death. And so in like the Jacob cycle, for example, it seems like there's a lot of more disconnected stories that are kind of, they're all about Jacob, but they're kind of patched together. Not in the sense that it wasn't written by one author, but it's not one long story. It's almost like more a series of stories that have a common theme. Probably the same thing could be said about the Abraham narrative, that it's a series of stories or events about Abraham that have common themes running through them, and they're all tied together. Whereas this seems to be just one long story from start to finish, and you know, as is written as a whole. And so it's fun to think of it from that perspective, and it would be fun to cover the whole thing in one night, although dealing with, you know, 14 chapters is probably a little much for one night. But remember, keep it in that perspective, that this is one story with one point, in one sense, that runs throughout the whole thing. And so you really do, in a sense, have to see it from beginning to end. And so we'll try to keep that in mind as we go through it, because, you know, with the other ones, it's like, okay, this little story has a point, this story has a point, this story has a point. Let's tie that all together and see the big picture that the author is getting at. In this, you more see God's working throughout this whole story to bring about his plan from beginning to end. And that's why you see more of the, if I could put it this way, the stepping stones that build one on top of the other to finally get to the end result, which is God bringing his people to Israel. And that's what's cool about it, is because it's so interconnected, it's so continuous as one story, you see how everything builds upon another and how God is orchestrating all of that. And that, I think, really is the beauty of this story, is to see how all those things are interconnected. So anyway, I kind of said that, but I just want to kind of keep emphasizing that, because I think that's really the key to this story, is seeing it as one long interconnected story which God is working from start to finish. All right, so we start off, and we start off with Joseph at 17 years of age, and it kind of introduces him shepherding along with his brothers. And it starts off, Joseph brought back an evil report or a bad report about them to their father. And so right off the bat, there's kind of tension. You know, people, I don't want to get into it really, but people go, well, okay, he's being a tattletale. And so, you know, it kind of reflects bad on Joseph or whatever. I don't necessarily know. I wouldn't stress that too much. Certainly later in the book, there's a big emphasis on the fact that he's a very wise man. He's recognized for his wisdom before Pharaoh. He flees temptation. All these different things that he's really put in a positive light. You know, maybe he's a little immature here, but I don't think that's really the author's point at all. It's more to show, I think, the brothers in a bad light, that he has to bring this bad report about them to his father. Now, what were they doing that was evil or what? You know, it doesn't say at all. It's just he had a bad report, brought it to his father. And so I don't think it's so much characterizing him as a negative light as his brothers. And as we'll see, his brothers, as this story starts off, are not the most kind people, I guess, in the world. And so we'll see that as we walk through here. But so it starts off right off the bat with this negative statement about his brothers. And then it starts off with after that kind of introductory statement, in verse 3, it gives us some background information. Now, all your translations may do this a little differently, but in Hebrew, there's this construction where they could give you some background information in a narrative. We call it a disjunctive clause. And it's very important because the author will often use this disjunctive clause to give you a piece of information that's going to be very relevant for the rest of the story. And so this construction in Hebrew often kind of colors what follows. I could give you lots of different examples from Ruth or from Jonah or different other books that I've translated. But I would say the way that this is written here is intended to give you, okay, it's almost like the author saying, okay, this is some key background information. That's really what verse 3 is. And so as you come in here, you often, the way it's translated in our English is it'll translate now. You know, you'll notice that verse 3 starts off with that now, at least in the NASB. Other translations may not bring that out, but it's kind of the idea of, you know, if you're telling a story, you're like, this happened, you're like, now, and then you kind of like, there was this man who blah, 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 and you kind of like, and then you go on and tell the rest of the story. And so that's what's happening here. You know, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And right off the bat, it kind of says, okay, Jacob's favoritism of Joseph is really going to color and flavor whatever follows. And so that's what you see in verse 4. Right? His brother saw that he was loved, and it caused this family tension. Shouldn't be anything new to us, right? Within Genesis, over and over, we've seen all this favoritism and the rifts that's created within the family. And so here we see the same thing. We see Jacob's favoritism of Joseph, and Joseph, therefore, is just hated. It starts off that his brothers hated him and could not speak to him peaceably. So there's this immediate just separation between Joseph and all his brothers. And obviously that's going to result in what happens in this chapter. Joseph being sold and almost murdered by his brothers. So that kind of sets the frame for what's about to follow. And so then it just continues on. We have that background information about why there's this rift, why these brothers don't get along, and the favoritism that in one sense, you could almost put it that way, started that off, but it just gets worse. And so verse 5 continues on. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And so you're just going to see this hatred grow and grow and grow as these brothers just hate Joseph, and there's this separation within the family. And so he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. It was just like increased hatred. You're just, you know, it started off with this favoritism, but you're just pouring fuel on the fire as he starts talking about how, you know, all his brothers are going to bow down. And once again, is the point so much that he was an arrogant young brat? I don't necessarily think so, but the point is more about his brothers and just their hatred of him. I mean, they were brothers, right? They should have been able to get along. They should have loved each other. And later in the narrative, that'll be brought out when Judah says, "Hey, look, don't kill him. He's our brother." And that term brother keeps coming out through here over and over and over. And I mean, even as you go to the Old Testament law, you know, it talks about your Israelites, your fellow brother. There shouldn't be any closer relationship than that. And so it's the irony, I guess, if you will, that there was this rift even among brothers. And so it continues on in verse 9. Says, "Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, 'Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me.' He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, 'What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?' His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind." Come on, no, come on up. No need to be shy here. So, obviously, he has a second dream. And within this whole Joseph narrative, you find a lot of pairs of dreams and different things. And certainly here, this just reemphasizes the same thing, but it kind of even builds upon it. Not only is his brothers going to bow down, not only is he going to rule over his brothers, but also his father and his mother. And so, once again, this dream is going to be, A, the thing that fuels their animosity towards him, but also kind of the prophecy, if you will, that's going to be fulfilled at the end of the book, or at the end of this section. And so, obviously, within Genesis already, we've seen a lot of prophetic dreams, and obviously, in this section, we'll see a lot of those as God is working through history, as he is in control of all things, he's able to predict the future. And that is a major emphasis of these different dreams. Because God is the one who's in control of the future, he can reveal it to whomever he wants. And so you see this dream which reveals what the future will be. And of course, his brothers just kind of hate him for it. But his father, it says, kept the saying in mind. And so he rebuked Joseph, but at the same time, he kind of, I don't know how you'd say it, but filed it away in the back of his mind and took note of the fact that this revelation was there. So it's just kind of an interesting little side comment that's made there. And so that starts off the kind of the background for what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter. So verse 12 continues on. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brother and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." Then the man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. So it kind of starts off, I think it's characterizing Joseph in a good light here. He's just obedient to his father. He's going to do what he said. But, you know, why this? It's kind of a weird statement. He runs into this man in the middle of the nowhere, this random guy. And I think once again, it's just kind of emphasizing the same point, as I said, that runs throughout this chapter. It's just like a lot of coincidences in this section, right? A lot of happen chance meetings, a lot of good timing. You know, he goes to where he thinks his brothers are, and are they there? Nope. And he just happens, he's wandering around. That's the word that's being used there. You can just imagine. It's like, it's not like he has a car or anything. They don't have cell phones, you know. It's just, he's just wandering around who knows where for miles. I don't know, just looking for them. And so this guy, he just happens to run into this guy, providentially, once again, able to ask him. And this guy happened to hear that they had gone on. And so once again, it just kind of, I would say, just emphasized that the timing, the sovereignty of God in making all these circumstances, there's so many circumstances that add up in this book. And so he goes to his brothers at Dothan. And so verse 18 really is kind of the culmination of this. When they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. And so as they see Joseph, they kind of scheme together, they plot together to put him to death because of this great, great hatred that they have for him. But Reuben, as the firstborn, apparently feels a very strong sense of responsibility for his father, and probably wants to be in his father's good graces even after what has happened earlier with him. And so he comes to them and is like, "Don't shed any blood, throw him into this pit." And so they listen to him, they throw him into this pit. We'll continue on, we'll kind of tie some of this together. Verse 25, then they sat down to eat a meal. That's a funny statement just even in and of itself, right? It shows kind of their callousness. Right, that they throw him in this pit and then they're all just eating, you know, around him. And you know, it's even funny that it's the same word where, you know, we'll tell our father that a wild beast ate him, and then they're eating. And it's almost like they're the wild beasts in a sense. They're the ones who are the evil ones who have thrown their brother into a pit. And so they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, the caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing an aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. So here we get introduced to Judah. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by. So they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Let me continue on. We'll come back and look at this. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted and said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So a lot of different themes there. Once again, you have the interplay between the brothers. You have Reuben, the oldest, who, feeling responsibility, puts forth this plan to spare Joseph because apparently of the responsibility he feels. But then his plan is thwarted, in a sense, by Judah, who comes in and really takes the leadership of the brothers and decides to sell him into the hands of these traders that were passing through. And it's interesting, as you get to the end of the story, I don't want to spoil the ending there, but Judah is really the one that's going to, you know, certainly he didn't do this out of love for his brother, but Judah at the end of the story is going to be the one who offers to take the place of the youngest brother, Benjamin. And so you're kind of being introduced to these various characters in the story. You see Simeon, in one sense, the failed leader who tries to take charge of the situation but fails. And you have Judah, who kind of steps up, in a sense, in terms of the brothers, but not in a good way. And you'll see how, in one sense, I was reading how, in one sense, Reuben is the foil to both Judah and Joseph, where these are kind of the two main characters that are going to be developed. And you see Judah's transformation over the story, and you see Joseph as kind of the main character. And so once again, you see all those interrelations of the brothers that has so much to do with the future of the nation. And of course, as we said, Judah being the kingly line, and how that skipped over over Reuben and Simeon and Levi, and ultimately went to Judah. And so, once again, just God's sovereignty in bringing about his nation. You also just see, once again, how just the timing of everything, right? You know, they're throwing him into this pit, and just at the right time, these traders come by, and they sell him to there, and obviously he ends up to Egypt, coincidence, ends up in Potiphar's house, coincidence. You know, once again, just God's working in such an amazing way to bring Joseph to where he needs to be to bring about his plan and purpose. Okay, any other just comments or questions from chapter 37? Once again, it's just keep the big picture in mind. It's just seeing God working even behind the scenes to bring about his plan and purpose.
I wonder if, it doesn't really seem to say if the father recognized the hatred of Joseph from the...
Yeah,
so their sons, because obviously it's just one part of wording, we don't know what else was worded, but just when they give the tunic, it's like, hey, I don't know if this is your son's tunic or not, he might be dead, you know. It's just no like grievances there at all. It's just kind of like I don't know, it's just baffles me, I guess, you know. It's just
their cold heartedness.
Well, just even if they covered it up well enough or not, I don't know. I'm curious about that. You know, I mean, it doesn't really say, I guess, but
Yeah, it's interesting too. Just even think about it. Just their, in one sense, just lack of care for their father. You know, that they would kill his son and kind of go lie to him. Once again, deception in the family, right? I guess that just runs in the family, being Jacob's sons. And you just see the result of it as the father is just mourning and refusing to be comforted. All right.
I have a technical question. It won't bother me unless we discuss it, you know? One of those things. Okay, it says that Okay, let's see. Oh, verse 27 says, come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not by our hands on him. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says the Midianites come along. So they pull, the Midianites, pull him out of the pit.
This is it, that you're...
And they sell to the Ishmaelites. And then it says, at the end of the chapter, that the Midianites sold them to Egypt.
It's debated. There's two ways you could take it. One is the Midianites and Ishmaelites, same group. Just two names for them. The other interpretation is just how you said it. And it really doesn't say. The grammar could go either way. I read some commentators that took it one way, some the other. To me, it's simpler just to see it as one group of people. It probably doesn't make too much a difference, and I didn't study in great depth, but that is a good question that's not simply answered from the text, unfortunately. It just says they, and the they could be the brothers that brought him up from the pit and sold him to this traveling group, or it could be that the brothers left him in the pit and one group came along and sold him to the other, but that doesn't seem to fit because Judah's suggestion was, let's sell them so that we could get the money. So I don't know. I that's why I would lean towards the fact that...
Maybe they sold them actually to the Midianites.
And the Midianites sold... That could be.
You know, okay, here, we'll take your 30 shekels and you can go have them. So they go and take them, and they in turn sell it to somebody else.
Could be. It doesn't make it very clear, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, because Midianites, I would think, would be further east.
Yeah.
I mean, people from further east, but they were there, right? In Shechem.
Yeah, they were trading, passing through. Yeah.
And Ishmaelites, I would think, would be... local people, more than likely. I mean, in that more...
Well, the Ishmaelites seem to have gone east, too, I think, if you go back.
Uh-huh.
Too. So they could have intermarried. That's one suggestion, that there's one group of people that kind of intermarried. It's hard. It's like I said, there's no way that we're going to be able to answer
it. Yeah, it just seems strange that the names are used. And then it says that the Midianites sold them in Egypt.
Right.
To Potiphar.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wish I could answer it.
I'll be sleeping and dreaming about this.
Okay. Did you have something, Lewis?
The turning of the clothes has always baffled me. What's up with that?
I think it's just an expression of mourning. You'll find throughout the Old Testament, various places that the putting of ashes on the head, the ripping of the clothes. It's just, I don't know that much about it other than it's a sign of contrition, a sign of mourning. These seem to be just ways that in their culture that they would express just extreme grief and sorrow. I think in Jonah, the king maybe did that. Maybe just put ashes. I can't remember. But you see at various times in the Old Testament, I know that expression is used. Seems to be just an extreme expression of mourning. I don't really know too much about it other than that.
Even like today, like in the Middle East, when you see people that have died and stuff, they're way more charismatic when it comes to mourning. Like the Western culture where it's like more reserved, you know, in private. There it's like more out there, you know.
The public mourners and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
You can get paid for doing that, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, have you heard of that? It's pretty interesting that they would even, like at funerals and stuff, they pay people to wail, you know, just to make it more, like you said, charismatic. Yeah. All right, so chapter 38. Chapter 38 is, in one sense, somewhat of a digression, but certainly, as we saw earlier with the story in chapter 34, the author's obviously putting it in here for a point, and so don't want to skip over it lightly. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Keziv that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of Yahweh, so Yahweh took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go in to your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so he went into his brother's wife. He wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of Yahweh, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up," for he thought, "I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who is by the road at Enaim?" But they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of the place said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep them, otherwise we will become a laughing stock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her." Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry." Then Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." And it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "I am with child by the man to whom these things belong." And she said, "Please examine and see whose signet ring and cord and staff are these." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah," and he did not have relations with her again. And it came about at that time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread in his hand, saying, "This one came out first." But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." So he was named Perez, which means breach. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread in his hand, and he was named Zerah. Kind of crazy story. And here we go. We've been introduced to Judah, and now we have Judah doing this crazy story about him. And, you know, you just start to think about this. This is, you know, the lion of the tribe of Judah. You know, we know the expression, and this is Judah, right? I mean, the whole thing starts off bad with him hanging out with the Canaanites and marrying a Canaanite woman. And he's got his best friend, apparently, is this Canaanite guy, and all this stuff. And then, you know, he gets a wife for his sons, and his first son's evil, his second son's evil. You don't get this glorious picture of Judah. And certainly, I think part of the point of this is to show the transformation that takes place in Judah's life by the end of the story. And certainly even just an evidence of God's grace in his life and God's sovereignty in one sense through all the events of his life that transpires in the story, how God transformed the man to be the man he is at the end. And so that's even awesome. I think that's one of the major points of this, is to show Judah in this negative light, to see the transformation that takes place by the end and how God uses even him in such an amazing way to be the father ultimately of King David, who is ultimately the father of the Messiah. So that's, I think, one of the emphases in here. Also, I think another emphasis is the fact that, you know, God is the one who's making sure that the line is preserved. You know, it was obviously Judah's job to, you know, he was the one that was responsible for making sure his sons and was given to the wife and the line is preserved and all of that. And he didn't really do a too good of a job at it, right? I mean, his first son is evil, so he dies. The second son doesn't do what his responsibility was to bring up children for the first brother. And so God kills him. And so, obviously, Judah promises to Tamar that she would be given to his third son so that the line would continue on. And I think that's a major emphasis in here is the line continuing on. But what does Judah do? What's he do? He doesn't do it, right? He doesn't keep his word. He tells Tamar that he'll do it, but he basically is afraid that his son's going to die. He doesn't trust in the Lord, and so he just doesn't obey. He doesn't do what he said. He breaks his promise. And he's the one that's supposed to be making sure that the line continues on and the seed continues on. But he totally fails in his responsibility. But ultimately, even through what is in one sense a terrible act, God is the one that's guaranteeing that the line continues on through this crazy act that Tamar does. And obviously you know the story. She dresses up like a prostitute. Judah goes into her. You know, she gets pregnant by him, and he's like, I mean, it's almost comical, right? What does he do when he finds out that she's pregnant? What does he say? Let's burn her. You know, he's the one that went into her. You know, he's the one, and yet she's the one. It's just like, oh, so ironic even. I think it's almost intended to be comical that you're reading this and you're like, are you kidding me? Like, he wants to burn her and he's the one that got her pregnant? I mean, it's just like, hello. And so then, of course, the punchline comes in. He recognizes, hello, you're the one that got her pregnant. And then that key statement, she's more righteous than I. And he recognizes, you know, wow, hello. And God just kind of turns the tables on him. And through all that, God brings about these children who ultimately, you know, like I said, King David will be born through. And it's a crazy story, but I think the point is, look how even through the midst of Judah's unfaithfulness, Judah's lack of fulfilling his responsibility, God's still bringing about the line. He's still ensuring that the seed, the line will continue on. And also to see how he's working in Judah's life to transform him from the man that he was to the man that he will be, who's willing to even take the responsibility and give his life for the sake of his brother at the end of the story. So it's pretty cool just to see how God's working within this and to see, once again, just his continued sovereignty. And this story seems like it's out of place, but it, once again, I think it has a lot to do with, once again, these two key characters, Judah and Joseph, which are, in one sense, the key tribes of the nation of Israel. And, of course, so key within the nation's later history. Anyway, I don't know what you do except for just kind of, in one sense, just marvel at this chapter and go, wow, that's crazy that God would use all of this to bring about his Messiah through this. You know, it's just unbelievable. Once again, just emphasizing God's sovereignty, God's plan, God's purposes being worked out, even in spite of sinful humans. Pretty cool. I will continue on because, once again, it is a story and we want to keep the flow of it. And so we'll see if we're able to make it as far as I was hoping. But so chapter 39 just continues on. And you know the story. I could probably even summarize some of this, but we'll see how far we get. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So there you go. You see the... sorry, but come back to your question, Aunt B. Now it's switched back to calling them the Ishmaelites.
Yeah.
And so, once again, that's probably a good key, quite possibly the same group. Doesn't prove it, but anyway. And so Yahweh was with Joseph so that he became a successful man. That's a key statement. Key statement. Yahweh is with Joseph. And just like we've seen that Yahweh was with Abraham, Yahweh was with Isaac, Yahweh was with Jacob, blessed whatever they did because they were the sons of promise, we see that God is with Joseph. God blesses everything that Joseph does. From this whole next section, God just continues to bless him in amazing ways. Everything, it's like, he's like, what's the story, the King Midas. You know, everything he touches turns to gold. That's Joseph. Everything he does, God prospers because he's promised that he would. Those who bless you, I will bless. It just goes back to God's promise that God is fulfilling through Joseph. And so that statement you see is just key throughout here. And so he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And so, once again, just as we saw earlier, everyone recognizes God's blessing. When God blesses someone, it's evident to all. And so his master saw that Yahweh was with him and how Yahweh had caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put him in his charge. And it came about that from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, that Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus Yahweh's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. Once again, that theme of blessing, right? That's that key word that keeps running throughout this book. God's blessing upon his chosen line, upon his chosen seed. And so at verse 6, so he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. You know, he trusted Joseph so much, Joseph was being blessed so much, that he didn't even, it's just like, Joseph, you run the house, I'm not going to worry about anything except for my food. You know, I'll eat, you take care of the rest. You know, and once again, it just shows God's amazing blessing on him. And of course, now, once again, one of these key background statements. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Once again, just Joseph's integrity. His great just wisdom is coming out here. His fear of God. Obviously, he's, I think, just being shown here as a very wise man, a man of character, that he would fear God in such a way that he would tell this to his master's wife. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household were inside. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, see, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. Then he heard that I raised my voice and screamed. He left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to make sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside. And when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. But Yahweh was with Joseph and extended grace to him, literally, and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge, because Yahweh was with him, and whatever he did, Yahweh made to prosper. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And so it's fascinating. As we continue on with this story, we may summarize it a little bit, but, you know, you see God working and just through circumstance, through circumstance, through circumstance. God is blessing him, and you see him kind of raised to this position of high authority, and you think, okay, here is how he is going to get into, you know, the leadership of the nation. This is how it's God's going to bring it out. But then God brings in this temptation. He even acts righteously in the temptation, and then he still gets thrown in prison. Once again, just how God is moving him from place to place. And just for sake of time, and just even, you know how this story goes, and so I don't need to elaborate on too much, but chapter 40 continues on, and he's in the prison, right? And he gets put in charge of everything in terms of the in the prison. And God is blessing him in everything that he does. And whether, you know, so the chief jailer puts him in charge, and he interprets these two dreams of, you know the story, how the chief cupbearer and the chief baker get thrown in the prison there. They both have dreams. And so Joseph interprets their dreams. And just when you think that Joseph has another way out, because the dreams get fulfilled and the chief cupbearer gets returned to Pharaoh, the chapter ends with Joseph saying, hey, remember me. I just interpreted the dream. You're going back to Pharaoh. Put in a good word for me with Pharaoh. And then the chief cupbearer forgets and doesn't get, you know, do the name dropping to Pharaoh. And so it's awesome to see here how just God's timing is being worked out, how God's plan is being worked out, that God is blessing Joseph in everything that he does. You see that so clearly. You see Joseph's wisdom. You see Joseph's fear of God. You see how he has such an amazing just integrity because he fears God. And I think such a great lesson for us is that things don't always work out as we think that they should or that we think that they will. Or just when we think God's plan is being worked out in a certain way, I'm on the uppity-up, I got to Egypt, I'm like Potiphar, this guy's high up in Pharaoh's household, and I'm his like chief dude, like all I gotta do is make it up a few more people, and I'll be, you know, right-hand man to Pharaoh. God like turns the tables and he ends up in prison. It's just awesome, and how God even uses that to bring him to the place where he will be Pharaoh's right-hand man. Just meditate on God's amazing sovereignty in this story. How it doesn't always work out how he would expect, and yet you see so clearly God working through all of these circumstances. You also see, and I kind of glanced over chapter 40 very quickly, but you see the fact that Joseph is very wise, even by the fact that he's able to interpret these dreams. God has given to Joseph this ability to prophetically interpret dreams, kind of like Daniel. And, you know, you think of Daniel, and certainly I think you would think of a wise person. And that's really how Joseph is characterized here as well. He's very wise. He's very discerning. God has given him, God is blessing him, blessing everything that he does. God is giving him spiritual discernment to be able to interpret dreams. And as we go on to chapter 41, we see his great discernment, even being able to administer the whole kingdom of Egypt, and how God finally is going to bring about the reversal that results in Joseph being brought all the way to the very throne itself. So just meditate on that and marvel about that for a while. How God has worked in such an amazing way to bring about this plan. The timing of it, you know, you could say, if this cupbearer hadn't have forgotten Joseph and he had told Pharaoh at that time, it would have been before the famine, and, you know, Pharaoh wouldn't have had need to have Joseph interpret his dreams, and he probably wouldn't have been made. I mean, you could just think of it from that perspective. Look how many steps fall perfectly into place so that Joseph's there at the exact right time when Pharaoh needs him, so that Pharaoh will put him in charge of the whole nation of Egypt. And indeed, you know, they were the most powerful nation of the world at that time. It's mind-boggling. And yet, I mean, just think about the application for us, right? That's the same God that we have. It's the same God who's in control of all things, that he is that powerful. He is that in control. We can trust him that greatly because that's who he is. And also, therefore, you know, the need to walk wisely like Joseph did, to flee from temptation, to fear God above all else, to recognize that if we fear God, God will bless us, maybe not in our timing. Right? It's such an important aspect of this, because Joseph had to wait like 13 years. He was in bondage, you know, until finally he was brought, you know, and there's ups and downs, right? From Potiphar's house to the prison to Pharaoh's right-hand man, and lots of waiting and God's timing in it all. When he thinks he's about to get out because he interpreted the dream, but then he's forgotten, right? When he thought he had a way out of the prison. And so it's just a great reminder to us that even in the low times, God can be bringing about something amazing from it. Even when we think we're in the pit, Joseph literally was in the pit twice. He was in the pit when his brothers threw him into the pit, and then this dungeon that he's in is called the pit. He was twice in the pits. But God used the pits to bring him up to basically the second most powerful man in the world. It's just an amazing story of God's sovereignty. And so as we finish out tonight, I wanted to do chapter 41 and see just, and once again, I don't think for sake of time we'll read the whole thing. You're very familiar with the story, but you know what happens. It happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he was standing by the Nile. And you know the story. You know, there were 7 fat cows, and the 7 lean cows eat the 7 fat cows, and then there were 7 fat stalks. Ears of corn, and the 7 lean ones ate those up, swallowed them up. And of course, you know, once again, 2 years after this cupbearer was supposed to name drop him to Pharaoh, he had forgotten him. But all of a sudden, Pharaoh has a dream, and the cupbearer says, "Oh yeah, I remember. There's this Hebrew that interpreted my dream." And so, at just the right time, they run, and none of the magicians of Egypt are able to interpret this dream, but God is the true God, right? He's the one that's in control of the future. He's the one that's sovereignly in control of all things. And so Joseph, because he's a follower of the true God, is able to interpret. So verse 8 says, you know, he called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and he told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them. And so once again, the cupbearer says, "Oh yeah, I remember Joseph. He could interpret the dreams." And so verse 14, they called for Joseph, they clean him up, they bring him in, and Pharaoh says, "No one can interpret it." And notice what Joseph says in verse 16. Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." And he doesn't take the credit for himself, right? He gives the credit to God and says, God is the one who's in control of history. God's the one who will bring about this interpretation. And so, basically, Pharaoh tells him his dream. Joseph interprets it. And as you come to the end of it, where is the interpretation? Verse 33, Joseph says, okay, here's the interpretation. There's going to be 7 good years and 7 bad years. That's the basic interpretation of it. And you come to verse 33. This is what Joseph's advice is. "Now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it." And so basically his idea is, okay, in the 7 good years, you're going to have just bounty upon bounty upon bounty. And so set someone who's in charge, who's wise, to take 1/5 of that bounty and set it aside for the years of famine that are coming. And so that's his advice. And though, notice what Pharaoh says in verse 38. Then Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit? Or even better yet, the spirit of God is in him?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are." Right? Once again, Joseph is the wise man. He's the one who can interpret dreams. He's the one who flees from temptation. He's the one who gives all the credit to God. He's the one who just is wise in all his actions. And so Pharaoh says, basically, you're the wise man. God has given you such great wisdom that I'm putting you in charge of everything. Absolutely everything in my house, I'm putting you over. And so he took the signet ring, he puts it on Joseph's hand, he basically has this big processional, it's like Joseph's the man. You know, and he just kind of rides him around in a chariot and declares to all Egypt that he's number two in all of the kingdom. I love that statement. Pharaoh said in verse 44, I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. You know, it's like, even though I'm the number one top dog, nothing in this whole country will happen unless you say it. You know, that's amazing. You know, how God brought Joseph to this place.
Well, isn't having the possession of the signet ring, didn't it make him equal in essence of power because he's using the Pharaoh's...
Yeah, I mean...
That's his stamp of approval.
Exactly.
So,
yeah, well, anything he stamped with that ring had all of Pharaoh's authority with it. And as you say, I mean, that, it's just amazing that God would bring him up and down and up and down and from the pit all the way to basically the most powerful person on the earth. It's
well,
crazy.
I was thinking about when you were talking about chapter 39. Let's see what verse it was. Verse 9, when he's refusing Potiphar's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, are you kidding? Your husband has put me in charge of everything. I'm responsible for everything. And he says, how then could I do this great evil and sin against your husband?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what he says. He says it would be a sin against God.
Yeah.
And he's not saying, I'm not going to betray my trust that your husband's given me. He says, I'm not going to sin against God.
Yeah.
That's what was important to him.
Yeah, exactly. And so you see he's just characterized as a wise man. And what does Proverbs say? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that statement you just said shows that he feared God. That ultimately he was looking to God and he wasn't concerned about the consequences from an earthly standpoint. And in the midst of it all, God blessed him. He brought him to the pit twice, but ultimately he does bring him up to this position of power. And so Joseph is the wise man. He stores up, it says in verse 49, he stored up so much grain, it's like the sand of the sea, and even stopped counting how much grain there was because it was beyond measure. There was so much grain in the 7 years of plenty. And of course, then the famine comes, but all the land of Egypt has grain because of Joseph's wisdom interpreting the dreams and carrying out this plan to make sure that there was enough grain in the land. And so that sets us up for reintroduction to Joseph's family, which we're going to come to next week. But certainly in this section, really the emphasis is, it's kind of a rags-to-riches story in a sense. You know, it's God's amazing sovereignty in bringing Joseph to this place of position, this place of authority, and just the timing, the sovereignty of it all. And as was said, just Joseph being the wise man who God uses because of his fear of the Lord, because of the wisdom that God had given him, that he gives all the credit to God and he fears God. And so I think for myself, the biggest lesson from all of this is, you know what? Even when, you know, the plan seems like it's going into the pit, to use the metaphor, even when it seems like God isn't doing what he's supposed to be doing, you know, Joseph knew that ultimately his father and his mothers are going to bow down to him. He's going to be in this position of authority. And I mean, certainly when he was sitting there in prison, it didn't seem like it was going to come about. Or when he was sitting in the pit. And yet, ultimately, God brought it about through all of that. And so, just remember whatever circumstances we're going through, right? That God's still in control. God's bringing about his plan, his purpose. And he calls us to just walk wisely. Is really the ultimate statement of this section. So anyway, we'll continue this story next time. We'll continue to see how God's bringing about his plan, ultimately to restore blessing to the world through the descendant of Abraham. But this is just a great, great section of God's amazing sovereignty and providence in working out amazing details. I hope we don't kind of gloss over it too quickly and forget how amazing what transpired is within here, that Joseph would be made the number one guy in all of Egypt. So a lot for us to learn there.
I was just thinking that throughout this entire process of going up and down, Joseph, it never mentioned him complaining or anything. It was always a stress. jail, you're going to complain. There's all these incidents, but through it all, he just seems to be just following God's call for him to be righteous.
Yeah.
And so, at least it resonates in my mind a lot of times. No matter what we go through, it's like, at least I don't see him complaining. So and just him trusting in God.
For sure. For sure.
And yet it must have been really hard because the names he gave his kids.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. The names, yeah. I didn't mention that, but you know, he names his firstborn Manasseh, for he said, verse 51, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. Obviously, he's been through a lot. And then verse 52, and he named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And so, once again, both his sons reflect the fact that he had been blessed even out of hard times. And he had gone through a lot to get to the position he's at. So that's a good observation. That's a good observation. Any other just questions or comments or just applications as we think about how this changes the way we think about life and think about God's plan? And
well, I think we should keep it in mind in the light of, shall we say, what's going on within our nation and the world itself, that God has a plan for the total world. And his, I don't know if this is a fair way of expressing it, but he is moving the checker pieces on the board to see that his plan is fulfilled. And so when we get worried and frustrated about, you know, shall we say, our local politics or our local situation, that we're in a bigger picture than just ourselves. We're in the picture that God is weaving for the world, you know.
That's a great point.
It's going to happen. We already know there's going to be disasters, right? Before the glorious eternity, okay? It's eternity that's going to be glorious. And we have yet to see the worst. And so we know that we're not living in the worst. And I think we can rejoice in that there are going to be people in this world that will be living in much worse situations.
That's a good reminder. And you also just see God's plan working out through individuals and just how God promised to bless Abraham and bless his seed, and you see God blessing Joseph. And so it's an amazing way that God says, I will bless those who bless you, and you see that working out. It's a reminder that God is in control, which is, of course, what we see through this section. So amazing, amazing to just reflect on those things. I think you hit on right what is the major point of this, right? That we could trust in God, whatever our circumstances. It gives us a global perspective, I think. It helps us to see that our little lives are a part of something much bigger, like you say, something global, something that God is working out in an amazing way. And so hopefully that helps us just to trust in the Lord, whatever we're going through, and to realize he's bringing about something amazing through it. That's good. All right, well, we can close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for what it reveals about you and your plan for this world. We thank you that you are able to work out minute details in ways that we can't even comprehend, sometimes in ways that baffle us, sometimes in ways that seem contrary to what we think would be best. But we see that you're working it out nonetheless, and you're bringing about your plan and your purpose. And we thank you so much for that. We thank you that even in the pit, we could trust in you, and that you call us to be wise and to be righteous wherever we are. And we just thank you for that. Thank you for the example of Joseph. I thank you for this story, which teaches us that you're in control of all things, and even the most powerful kingdoms on the earth, you are moving to bring about your glorious plan. And so we thank you, even just the reminder that you're the one that guarantees that the seed continues on. And we know that ultimately that's fulfilled in our Lord Jesus Christ. And so we just thank you for him. Help us to trust you in all that we do. In Christ's name, amen. Mm-hmm.